Hey, how you doing? Welcome back to Pass Gas. This week, it's part one of our two-parter on the life of Enzo Ferrari, a very complicated guy, loved racing, duh. Let's just get into it. Let's just read the dang story. How about that? No more preamble. Before the red paint, before the prancing horse, before the name Ferrari meant anything at all, there was just a man with a dream and a chip on his shoulder, the size of Modena. Enzo Ferrari didn't grow up rich or with connections. What he had instead was obsession, a burning desire to go fast and to win. Winning was at the heart of every decision he made. Every race was a battle, and every loss was personal. In the chaos of post-war Italy, Enzo Ferrari built something that would come to define excellence. A stubborn kid from outside Bologna who went from sweeping garage floors to running the most legendary team in racing history. What Italian car maker gave young Enzo his first shot? How did he prove himself behind the wheel? And what events led to him retiring from racing? Today on Pass Gas, we're diving into the early days of the godfather of speed. It's Enzo Ferrari.
You come to me on this day of my race and I got an offer you can refuse.
That's how it goes, right?
I really think impressions come from the face rather than like the sound, right?
Yeah. Oh, because
you're doing like the Marlon Brando Godfather.
The underbite.
Are you
and
packing
the
your
eyebrows.
Lip with
he packed it with
a lot
cotton.
Of cotton or anything like that?
Oh, cotton. That's what he did?
I think so. Cotton balls.
No, just teeth.
Just your teeth?
Yeah.
Nice. Well, welcome back to Pass Gas, everybody. My name is Nolan Sykes. Those voices you heard across from me, it's Bart Bidlingmeyer.
Hi, happy to be here. Thanks for having me. I don't think they heard my voice yet, though.
I thought you commented on, you just said cotton balls.
Oh, I did say cotton balls. It was my nickname in high school.
Cotton balls, and I was Cotton Eye Joe.
And that's Cotton Eye Joe Weber. Hello, everybody.
Hey, what's
you doing?
Up? How's it going? I'm good. I'm doing great, actually.
Good.
I'm feeling good.
Good, good.
I actually got sleep last night.
I've been sleeping terribly recently.
I've been like waking up. Like, sure, you wake up in the middle of the night. That happens.
Sure.
But then like, kind of, God, I can't sleep. And then I kind of wake, you know, move around. And then I'm like, why can't I get back to sleep? But I'm like, oh, but I did just have a dream. I must have fallen asleep for a minute. You know, like it's just, but I don't feel like I've slept, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the worst.
So we're coming full circle here today. We started Past Gas with the story. I feel like I'm hunched over with the story of Enzo Ferrari versus Ford. Ford versus Ferrari. That was the first like four episode arc here on the show. And now we are covering Enzo Ferrari's life in more detail on this episode, in this two-part episode.
This is a two-part episode to round out season one of Past Gas.
That's right.
320 episodes.
Yes.
Insane. With no break, basically. And we're going to, you know, have a nice little holiday. We're going to regroup and we're coming back in 2026 with such a cool season arc, JDM golden era arc. It's going to be really cool.
Yeah. So very excited for that. So we thought it'd be appropriate to kind of come full circle here and, talk about one of the most influential and legendary figures in car history here.
Before we start, I just really want to thank everyone who listened over the years. It's been cool to see how people respond to this kind of stuff. And what started as an experiment kind of grew into this bigger, actually huge thing that just kept on going. Mm-hmm. And we wouldn't have kept doing it if you guys didn't comment and DM us and respond and come to our live show, our one live show that somehow took years to produce. But yeah, thank you guys from the bottom of our hearts. Mm-hmm. It's been really fun and we're really excited for the next chapter and we hope that you stay tuned.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was so fun, so amazing. Just adding on to what Joe just said, like when we're shooting Big Trip, going across the country, we ran into people who worked a ton of different kinds of jobs, from trucking to running like a gun shop to working in warehouses, all that kind of stuff. Like just such a wide spectrum of people who listen to the show all the way through on their work day. And this means so much. And, you know, I'm just looking forward to the next stage of the show.
I will say that podcast fans are way cooler to talk to. I won't talk. I'm only talking for my own reasons. Podcast fans are like, oh yeah, I you know, they'll cite like a specific thing that we talked about in a random episode. It's always a great conversation. And I feel like podcast people really pay attention.
For sure. Absolutely. So we thank you. And with that, shall we
do it? Yeah.
Shall we do
it? Let's shout.
Let's talk about Enzo Ferrari. Enzo Anselmo Giuseppe Maria Ferrari was born on February 18th, 1898 in Modena, Italy.
Did you say Maria or Mario?
Maria.
Maria. I didn't know. Why did I not know that?
Although some initial records said otherwise. A blizzard had swept across northern Italy that week, isolating towns and freezing railways. The storm was so severe that his father and the midwife couldn't even report his birth until days later.
Did you know that the top of Italy is the latitudinal equivalent of parts of Canada?
Really?
Yeah. Whoa. And the bottom of it is like just around New York City-ish.
Wow. That's way higher than I thought.
Yeah.
Huh.
Man, once this Gulf Stream starts messing up a little bit, Europe's going to be kind of f***ed, isn't it?
So, in the confusion, officials recorded his birthday as February 20th, even though he was born 2 days earlier.
I see.
Yeah. Enzo Ferrari didn't come from a family.
So, why didn't they just record that?
Like, I don't know.
You didn't believe him.
Yeah.
Enzo Ferrari didn't come from a family of nobility or wealth. His father, Alfredo, ran a metalworking shop out of the basement of their home. It was modest work. At the turn of the 20th century, Italy's economy offered little in the way of upward mobility. If Enzo had followed the path in front of him, he might have lived out his days as a blacksmith, hammering steel like his dad before him.
Or a fettuccine miner.
But even as a boy...
Is that where they get that?
Yeah.
Deep in the mountains of Sicily.
Yeah.
But even as a boy, Enzo wanted more. His childhood dreams took strange shapes. First, he wanted to be
like a fusilli.
First, he wanted to be an opera singer, then a sports writer. It was only after a life-changing experience that he realized he was meant to be a race car driver. That moment came in 1908, when Enzo was just 10 years old. His father took him to see Felice Nazzaro compete in the Circuito di Bologna. Nazzaro was already a legend. He was a charismatic, fearless, and elegant driver behind the wheel. That day, he drove to victory in front of a roaring crowd. Throughout this race,
elegant, they meant he wore a scarf,
yeah,
around his head with dark glasses, big dark glasses,
and he waved like this.
Yeah.
Throughout the race, as the cars approached the circuit's most dangerous corners, Enzo noticed that the race organizers had taken a peculiar safety measure. They had flooded the ground alongside the road to a depth of 1 foot for nearly 40 yards. The idea was simple. If a car veered off the course, the water would slow it down, protecting the spectators. This minor detail, meant to preserve life, revealed something profound to young Enzo. The planning and foresight that went into it all. The risk and the reverence for danger. That day, Enzo Ferrari discovered something that would live inside him forever.
A tapeworm.
With just one encounter with the world of racing, he was hooked. Much like a hookworm.
It's funny that a safety feature was the thing that got him like, oh, maybe just to think about it.
Yeah, it made him think, yeah.
That's crazy, though.
Someone told me, because I like didn't really care about sports when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And this kid that was like an amazing athlete, but didn't really want to play sports that much. But his dad was like forcing him to, you know, be a quarterback and play baseball and stuff. He was like, yeah, I don't really like sports, but I'll find like one thing to focus on that I think is impressive. And I'll like get kind of open the door for the sport. And I started thinking about sports in that way. It was like, well, it is really hard to like, you know, do a pick and roll. And that's kind of what I feel for Enzo, because I do that with sports.
I was going to ask what you think the most hardest thing to do in sports is. But
I want to definitely hit. This is my bias showing, but hit a baseball with a bat, hit a round ball with a round bat, and be able to place it where you want. I think I think that's been, it's a huge discussion on Instagram mm-hmm. right now. Like, if you listen to the podcast, All the Smoke with Matt Barnes, and they have like all these sports stars on mm-hmm. and like most of them agree that hitting a baseball is the hardest thing to do in sports.
Yeah. So I guess it's not that bad that I was terrible at baseball when I was a kid, huh? Dad,
no, give him a, give him slack, Scott.
Give me some slack. He actually had to stop coaching me in baseball because he was taking it too seriously.
You came and hit balls for our practice and you were doing good.
Thanks, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You had fun and then you were like,
I did.
I want to come back. And then that was 6 years ago.
Yeah, that was because that, dude, that was out in Burbank.
Though. I know.
So far away. I do remember that other time we were hitting balls out in West LA
yeah,
near the old office.
With Red Pad.
And I like threw my shoulder out.
Oh, man.
And, yeah.
Yeah.
I do like baseball.
Bar was in our league.
Yeah.
That's actually where we cut our teeth together.
Mm-hmm. We and also tore the hamstring. Do you remember I had a wrap in my car?
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if Mark's behind the board going, oh, no one was hitting? Wait a minute. Can we utilize this guy? Okay. Anyway. In the early 20th century, Italy's political unrest and economic strain found itself being compounded by war, first against the Ottoman Empire, then against Austria-Hungary in the First World War. Like so many young men of his generation, Enzo Ferrari enlisted without hesitation. He joined Italy's 3rd Mountain Artillery Regiment, a unit tasked with defending the rugged terrain of northern Italy. Isn't like the Alps up there too?
Yeah, there's mm-hmm. Italian
Isn't
Alps.
Isn't them Alps up there?
There's the Dolomites on Dolomites. The west side, and then I think the Alps okay. that border up with Switzerland.
Okay. War hardened Enzo. But even more than the combat, it was the loss of those close to him that would prove to be more defining. In 1916, while Enzo was still a teenager, the Spanish flu swept across Europe like wildfire. It took his father first. Then it took his older brother, his only sibling, Alfredo Jr. Enzo was left alone, young, and grief-stricken. Amid the chaos and devastation of those brutal years, Enzo Ferrari found an anchor in the bond he shared with a mentor and friend, one Francesco Baracca. A national hero and one of Italy's most revered fighter pilots, Baracca embodied the traits Enzo admired most. He was courageous, well-disciplined, and always carried with him an unshakable sense of purpose. But it wasn't just Baracca's prowess in the skies that left a lasting impression. Around his neck, he wore a necklace crafted by his mother, adorned with the image of a horse reared up on its hind legs.
He's actually the reason that machine guns on planes sound like Baracca, 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 Baracca. Nice. Sorry, that was dumb.
Enzo saw in that emblem a kind of spiritual defiance. It would leave a mark on him far deeper than the battlefield ever could. Its significance would only strengthen with the passing of Francesco Baracca in 1918. His plane was shot down by an Austrian fighter. The necklace was never recovered. Enzo fell gravely ill in the final months of the war, his body wrecked by the same virus that had taken his family. Doctors feared he wouldn't make it. But somehow, whether by strength, luck, or sheer refusal, Enzo pulled through. He emerged from the war gaunt, wounded, and haunted. And yet, he was alive. He had no family left, no obvious future. But he did have one thing, a desire to do something with his life that would bring him joy. He turned to the only thing that made sense in the aftermath of death, movement. The automobile industry in post-World War I Italy was still fledgling, but it offered him something no other line of work could: speed, precision, and control. In the roar of an engine, he found the chaos of his mind quieted. In the act of assembling metal into machinery, he rediscovered his purpose. He threw himself into cars with obsessive focus, not only repairing them, but envisioning a future where he was behind the wheel.
I'm just realizing like how history keeps repeating itself, where like, this is early on in the auto industry, but like young guys coming back from war, mm-hmm. like this is their therapy. Mm-hmm. And then they like end up making some of the coolest machines and doing some of the daring shit that like gives them the adrenaline they had during the war. And then that repeats with World War II. And like every country you see that, like the Bosozoku, mm-hmm. The Hell's Angels, like all that shit oh, yeah. is tied to like PTSD, basically.
Huh. Yeah.
Because guys will do anything but go to therapy.
Driving? That's my therapy. Actually, no, I started going to therapy and it's been quite helpful. I will
therapy?
Say.
That's my therapy.
It's a good bumper sticker.
Therapy's my driving.
Therapy? That's my driving.
I don't drive.
I don't drive. I take taxis.
Bart walked here. After being discharged from the army, Enzo carried with him a letter of recommendation from his colonel. It was addressed to Fiat, the powerhouse of Italy's early auto industry over in Turin. For Enzo, this was the golden ticket. He saw it as proof that his service and his resilience might earn him a place in something bigger. Enzo traveled to Fiat headquarters full of hope, ready to prove himself. There, he met with the head engineer, one Diego Soria. But the meeting was brief. Soria explained that hundreds of ex-servicemen just like Enzo were applying. Fiat couldn't possibly hire them all. There was just no place for Enzo. And like that, the door was closed.
That's such a shitty thing to say to somebody. It's like, we can't hire you all. It's like, I don't care. Just hire me. Like, what do you mean you can't? I know you can't hire everybody.
Yeah.
You could hire me.
It's a compelling case.
Yeah.
You just stare at them too and they'll crumble.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
With no job and no family to fall back on, Enzo spent the winter of 1918 broke, cold, and utterly alone. He wandered the streets of Turin in the snow, aimless. Most days he would sit quietly in Valentino Park, watching strangers pass by. He cried there, sometimes from the cold, sometimes from hunger, and sometimes from the weight of everything he had lost. Good Lord.
He's pretty young at this point, and yeah, he's
a little young to be a pigeon guy.
A pigeon guy.
You just sit in the park and feed the pigeons.
Sometimes you got to do what you got to do.
Man, dude. In the wake of personal tragedy and wartime failure, Enzo Ferrari found luck in a not-so-glamorous gig. His first real job came through a man named Giovanni, who dealt in stripped-down, second-hand light trucks like the Lancia Zeta. Giovanni's operation was simple. Remove the bodies, keep the chassis, and sell them to coach builders. Enzo became a link in the chain. He tested and retested these frames before delivering them to Corazzeria Italo Argentina in Milan. There, these skeletal remains were reborn into something beautiful. Torpedo-bodied cars, streamlined and striking, coveted by the era's upper crust.
It's kind of got the torpedo shape, but it's got big running boards on the bottom.
It's your classic early 1920s look.
Yes.
You know, because again, they're working with truck frames. So like there's not a lot.
At the end of the day, they're truck frames.
Back in the day, man. I had a frame like a truck. So
I could rimp a stump out.
I could rimp a stump out. It wasn't glamorous work, but for Enzo, it was something to keep his hands and his mind busy. Testing the chassis meant understanding feel, balance, and strength. It was his first real taste of what machines were capable of when pushed, refined, and perfected. When he wasn't working, Enzo could be found lingering at the Bar del Nord near Porta Nueva in Turin. There, among coffee cups and cigarette smoke, he mingled with the fringes of Italy's racing and engineering scene. One key figure he met was one Romolo Bonaccini, a well-regarded mechanic and former flight engineer who had worked with Brock Papa, one of Italy's pioneering aviators.
I love it when you call me Brock Papa.
Bonaccini took an interest in the young Ferrari. He mentored him not just in mechanics, but in philosophy, in how to think like an engineer and a competitor. Later in life, Enzo would say that what Bonaccini taught him was more important than any formal schooling he might have missed. As the money left to him after his father's passing began to dry up, Enzo needed something more substantial. Salvation came in the form of a new friend, one Ugo Savucci. Ugo was a former cyclist who had transitioned into motor racing and testing. The two met at Bar Vittorio Emanuele, a kind of sporting fraternity for young men with a taste for automobiles and machinery. Ugo Savucci convinced Enzo to leave Turin and come to Milan, where he was working as chief test driver for a company called CMN, or Costruzione Meccanica Nazionale. CMN had once made four-wheel drive tractors for artillery use during the war, but with peacetime, they pivoted to cars, repurposing surplus 3-liter four-cylinder monoblock engines from Isotta Fraschini into new chassis. Enzo decided to take the leap. At CMN, Ferrari finally got his foot in the door. His first job was as a test driver, putting the resurrected vehicles through their paces. That's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. That's super cool.
That's a cool job. In addition to testing cars, Enzo rode along with CMN motorcycles during races, carrying fuel and tools to support the riders. This made him a presence in the racing world, even before he had the chance to compete himself. But that chance would come soon. In 1919, at the age of just 21, Enzo Ferrari officially entered the world of competition. His first race was the Parma Poggio di Borchetto hill climb, a narrow and winding ascent through the Apennine countryside. It was the perfect arena for a raw but determined young driver. He didn't win, but he made an impression by finishing fourth, which gained attention from more experienced racers and team directors. Later that year, he entered the legendary Targa Florio. It was a brutal, unforgiving race through the mountainous terrain of Sicily. Enzo's car developed a leaking fuel tank midway through the race, a problem that would have ended the race for many, but he pressed on and still managed to finish ninth in a field of professionals. After several seasons of racing and working alongside Ugo Civoci, the two made the leap together to Alfa Romeo, which was a team on the rise. Enzo became a full-time driver for Alfa, assigned car number 14. His first major victory came in 1923 at the Savio Circuit in Ravenna, a winding track where he first encountered one Count Enrico Baracca, father of Francesco, the fallen fighter pilot whose leaping horse had once captivated Enzo during the war. It was here that the Count offered him permission to adopt the symbol for himself. And so, the prancing horse would rise again.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now, back to the show.
Enzo racked up a string of victories between 1923 and 1924, including wins at the Coppa Acerbo in Pescara and races in Ravenna and Polesine. He would go on to place in 11 of the 41 Grand Prix races he entered. By the mid-1920s, his name was well known throughout Italy's motorsport scene. But with the success came more loss. In 1923, during practice for the Italian Grand Prix at Monza, Ugo Civoci lost control of his car in a treacherous bend, then crashed and died. That same stretch of track would later claim the life of another Italian legend, one Antonio Ascari, and eventually become known as the Ascari Bend years later. Ugo's car bore no number that day, with superstitious drivers believing that that contributed to his fate.
I wonder why he didn't have a number.
I don't know.
I mean, Italians are very superstitious. Like, Ascari, like, they assigned so much meaning to him and his son's death. They did die on the same day, like 30 some odd years apart. But one of them was not using his lucky helmet when he died.
That's right. I think that was his son, wasn't it?
The one that goes into the bay at Monaco. He had a different color helmet or something. Okay. Then he didn't wear a helmet when he hopped in for like one lap around Monza and he died. But yeah, there's a lot of superstition.
Interesting. Wear your helmet. Enzo never forgot the silence that followed the crash. The weight of it all began to dull the thrill of victory. Enzo loved racing, but he loved it less than the people it kept taking from him. And so he made a private vow. If he ever had a son, he would stop racing. That day came in 1932 with the birth of Alfredo Dino Ferrari. Enzo kept his promise. He stepped away from racing and transitioned into a managerial role at Alfa Romeo. Alfa's Giorgio Rimini, head of sales and racing, had previously encouraged Enzo to build his own team within the brand. The result was Scuderia Ferrari, a semi-independent racing division formed in 1929. Under Enzo's behind-the-scenes leadership, Scuderia Ferrari became a powerhouse. They recruited top drivers and elite technicians, many of whom Enzo had convinced to defect from Fiat after Fiat shuttered its own racing program.
Wow, so they're almost going to be 100 years old. What? Scuderia Ferrari. Yeah.
That'll be fun.
That'll be fun, dude. Can you just mark it off in your calendar?
Yeah. With Alfa's Tipo P3 cars and a deep roster of talent, deeper than the Dodgers. Ferrari's team became nearly unbeatable. Baseball. Okay. Ferrari's team became nearly unbeatable in the early 1930s. But away from the track, a different kind of conflict was brewing. Enzo clashed with Ugo Gobbato, the new general manager of Alfa Romeo. Ugo must have been like a There must have been like a show on it. There must have been like Game of Thrones on at that time that had a character, named Ugo. Yeah, yeah, and like everybody was naming their kid Ugo. The two disagreed on the direction of development, structure, and the philosophical heart of racing. And eventually, that tension boiled over. In 1939, Enzo was forced out. A clause in his contract barred him from building or competing with any race car bearing his name for at least 4 years. That September, he founded Auto Avio Costruzioni in his hometown of Modena. On paper, it was a company that provided machine tools and aircraft parts, but Enzo had other plans. He was alone again and removed from Alfa, removed from his drivers, removed from the name he had spent years building. But he remembered the words of his father. Quote, a company is perfect when the number of partners is uneven and less than three.
I love that.
In other words, stay small, stay sharp, and trust yourself.
Yeah, I've also heard the best size for a committee is three people and one's out sick and the other just didn't show up. It's the most effective committee.
In secret, Ferrari began designing a new car. By 1940, when World War II was beginning to engulf the continent, Enzo had produced two prototypes of the AAC Tipo 815, named for their 1.5-liter eight-cylinder engines. They were fielded by Scuderia Ferrari, which was still operational in a support capacity, and even entered into the Mille Miglia, a brutal 1,000-mile endurance race across northern Italy. The two 815s were driven by Alberto Ascari, who was Antonio's son, and Littorio Rangioni. Because of the legal clause still active, the cars could not bear the Ferrari name. No prancing horse, no yellow shield. Both cars failed to finish the race. Mechanical issues forced them into early retirement. They vanished after the event, never to be seen again. But Enzo didn't mourn them. To him, a car that couldn't race was pointless. He had no use for romantic relics, no sentimental shrine to past efforts. What mattered was what came next. By the early 1940s, the roar of race cars had gone quiet. World War II swept across Europe, bringing with it not just violence and scarcity, but a fundamental shift in priorities. Speed, luxury, and competition had no place in a world rationing rubber and steel. Italy, under the rule of Benito Mussolini, was a nation gripped by ideology and fear. And for those, like Enzo Ferrari, trying to keep a business alive, compromise became a survival tactic. Now, I don't know if it's compromise exactly that we're going to be talking about here.
That's a little gentle on him.
That is, yes. Yeah. Enzo was a registered member of the National Fascist Party, and publicly, he appeared to align with Mussolini's regime and its utopian vision of Italian industrial supremacy. And he also like spent a lot of time hanging out at like the Fascist Party headquarters. Yeah. They had this big mansion. This was before World War II. He was definitely down to clown, guys, for sure. Yes, so the image is jarring. The stoic Enzo, so fiercely independent in racing, marching in lockstep with authoritarian power. Later, he would claim it was never about belief, but about preservation. To refuse loyalty to the regime in fascist Italy was to risk imprisonment, the seizure of property, or worse. Whether this was revisionism or truth is difficult to know. And like many industrialists of that era, Ferrari walked a careful line. But like I said, did a lot of partying with these guys.
Yeah, the pictures don't lie.
Yeah. Same goes for like Ferdinand and Porsche.
I mean, Henry Ford.
Henry Ford was,
Ford was a huge Hitler fan. And well, he didn't
Hitler was a big Ford fan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know.
Yeah. So
they're pen pals.
Henry Ford went out of his way to be a fan of Hitler.
Hitler had a portrait of Henry Ford in his office.
In a heart frame.
Like, Henry Ford was a little locket. Henry Ford was not a good guy.
No.
Smart guy, but not a good guy. Anyway, all these guys are, yeah. Of course, they'd want, quote, you know, the utopian vision of Italian industrial supremacy.
Yeah.
All these guys want industrial supremacy. You know, they all think they're smarter than everybody else. Anyway, in the war's later years, as northern Italy fell increasingly under German occupation and later became a hub for anti-fascist resistance, Enzo began to shift. He quietly opened his doors to socialists. The Socialist Federation's headquarters in Modena was housed in a building he owned. That's very strange. Meanwhile, the future of his company had to evolve. In 1943, he moved Otto Avio Construzione to Maranello, a sleepy town just outside of Modena, tucked between the Apennine and the Po Valley. And this was done because of the industrial decentralization law that was being imposed on factories. He had about 40 workers at Modena, and this number increased considerably in the course of the war. The plot of land, once used for growing cherries and seasonal fruit, would later become hallowed ground, the Fiorano test track, the very heartbeat of Ferrari's racing research and development in decades to come. But in 1943, it was still farmland. Instead of race cars, Ferrari's workers, many of them women, were building small four-cylinder engines for training aircraft commissioned by the Compagnia Nazionale Aeronautica in Rome. The shift in production was necessary, but it humiliated Enzo.
The difference between like a maraschino cherry and like a Luxardo cherry is insane, but they're basically the same thing.
I thought a maraschino was just stored in the syrup, and that's what gave it its flavor.
Yeah, but same with the Luxardo cherry. Have you ever had a Luxardo cherry?
Is the Luxardo the really bright one?
No, it's the really dark one.
Oh yeah, I love those.
That they put in fancy cocktails.
Yeah. Those are really
But they good. Are kind of the same process.
Would it be messed up to buy a whole jar of those just to snack on?
No.
No, they're very good.
It's $25 for a jar, though.
Oh, never mind. That's but too much. That's Taco Bell pricing.
I was going to say that there are affordable, high-quality maraschino cherries that aren't like the bright neon red ones.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I don't trust the ones that are good. See-through.
Right.
The glossy cherries.
Well, they put them in lye. Those cherries, like,
oh, to, or like, to clear.
Well, yeah, to like preserve them and process them, and then they use a bunch of red food coloring.
It's like that mouse that they found that fell in the vat of degreaser.
Yeah.
Have you seen this?
No.
You can see through them like a cherry.
Oh. Okay, yeah. So it just skinned them, right?
But it turned his skin into glass or whatever. Oh. You know, like you can see through him.
Its skin's still on? It didn't come off there? No? I don't.
I think it's just like made him clear. I don't think I think he has skin. I think it's just clear skin.
Yeah. Anyway.
It's like,
you mean like he had like realizations about his life.
Yeah.
That he couldn't have done with.
Much like I'm having right now.
OT level 3.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now back to the show.
As the war raged on, Ferrari's operation in Maranello evolved from a reluctant producer of training aircraft engines into something more profitable, yet controversial. Through his colleague Enrico Nardi, Enzo was introduced to one Corrado Gatti, a machine tool dealer from Turin. Gatti needed someone to replicate a specific type of German-made grinding machine called the Jung, spelled with a J.
Mm-hmm.
The Jung.
Jung.
Jung. The Jung.
I think it's Jung. It's Jung. Like,
yeah.
It's the Jung used to the Jung was used to manufacture ball bearings, which was a key component in almost every wartime engine and machine.
It's all about ball bearings these days.
And Enzo, desperate to keep his factory running, agreed. Officially, he had no license to reproduce the German Jung designs, but thanks to a legal loophole, Italian law permitted the replication of foreign machines not yet produced domestically. How convenient is that? Ferrari's team built replicas so faithful that not even German engineers could tell the difference. The machines were sold discreetly, often under the table, and manufactured in secrecy. It's like Haas selling CNC machines to... Oh, wait. That was like a third-party kind of deal.
What happened?
Haas was caught selling CNC machines to Russia
multiple
times.
Wow.
Anyway.
Gene, what are you doing?
I don't really know what the full story on that is. Full disclosure. These replicas quickly gained a reputation for their reliability and performance. And so much so, in fact, that even German clients began placing orders for them. At one point, a convoy carrying the machines was ambushed by anti-fascist partisans, and the units were believed to be destroyed. But legend has it that Ferrari recovered the wreckage, stripped off the identifying plates, replaced them, and sold the same machines back to the Germans. At night, the partisan fighters...
It's like when you sell someone a dog and then you blow the whistle and they run to your back to your house.
Or it's like if you take... It's like if you're buying chairs, removing parts,
and then selling the chairs back, right?
Yes.
At night. Like that'd be huge if that were true.
That would be huge if that was true.
That guy at the shirt store is the weirdest actor I've ever seen.
He's about at his limit.
I think they do cast intentionally that way.
Like the guy with the dent in his head.
This shirt is at its limit.
Yes. and he appears later. He comes, they bring him back.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's great.
I haven't watched past season five or episode five yet.
So at night, these Italian freedom fighters would come to Enzo's factory in Maranello to have weapons repaired or commissioned.
Whoa. So he was playing both sides. He was
playing both sides. The Stella Aguzza Tray, a caltrop device designed to puncture tires and stop enemy vehicles in their tracks, was one such creation. Whoa. Enzo's workers would hide among the machines by day, rifles stashed beneath benches and floorboards, and if the wrong visitor arrived, they were ready to fight. This shadow life went through 1944 and into 1945.
So it seems more like Enzo's employees were anti-fascist, and Enzo was...
I don't know. They're shades to this guy. Shades to this guy.
So this is before Mussolini was toppled.
Yeah.
He probably saw the tides turning and was like, oh, I better code switch.
The danger wasn't only from the Germans. In 1943, a fascist group placed Enzo Ferrari on a list of industrialists marked for censure or execution. In northern Italy, such threats were not idle. Executions of business owners accused of treachery, sabotage, or disloyalty had become common. By 1945, Ugo Gobbato, managing director of Alfa Romeo, was shot dead on his way to work. Eduardo Weber, inventor of the iconic Weber carburetor, also vanished without a trace. Are you related to this guy?
No. Weber is the third most popular.
Common. Not.
Weber is the third most common last name in Germany. It's kind of just like Smith.
Okay.
My dad did not like that fact because he thinks that we are special little snowflakes.
Ferrari was next. Rumors swirled that a criminal gang masquerading as partisan fighters had placed a price on his head.
You know, there's a Bidlingmeyer bakery in the Alps, a little coffee shop.
Oh, you should go there.
Yeah.
You should. Enzo responded not with negotiation. He is believed to have met with the coordinator of his own assassination and bought his life back by raising a large sum to pay off the would-be hitmen.
Smart.
At the same time, Enzo began quietly helping others survive. When Dr. Manzotti, a known fascist leader, defected and denounced the Nazi regime, Ferrari personally smuggled him out of danger. Driving a borrowed 1938 Lancia Aprilia saloon, Enzo carried Manzotti as he hid under a blanket through roadblocks and checkpoints in the moonlit Italian countryside, delivering him to a safe house near Ferrara.
I love how thorough these checkpoints were.
Yeah.
Nothing back here but a blanket, boss. All right. Along.
Why did that play?
Still, Enzo's conflicting allegiances made travel dangerous. Fascist, socialist, nationalist, partisan, his name had been whispered among them all. Roadblocks sprang up randomly, and each one of them held the potential for capture or worse. Then came November 1944. A series of air raids by the U.S. Army Air Corps struck northern Italy. The Maranello factory, being barely a year old, was bombed, and was hit again in February of 1945. Despite the extensive damage, Enzo had planned ahead. The wartime machine tool contracts had made him wealthy enough to rebuild. In 1945, with the fascist regime collapsed and the war nearing its end, Ferrari bought out the last of his partners in Scuderia Ferrari. He renamed the company Auto Costruzioni Ferrari, signaling a new era and a return to his first love, competition. He began to design race cars again. The first creation of the reborn factory was a 1.5-liter Tipo 125. To mark this new beginning, Enzo revived a symbol long etched into his heart, the rearing horse worn by his fallen friend, Francesco Baracca. The prancing horse, or Cavallino...
that horse needs to go to the vet.
Yeah, for real.
He's mostly glue.
The prancing horse, or Cavallino Rampante, would go on to become the most iconic badge in automotive history. It carried with it the memory of fallen friends, the imprint of war, and the spirit of a man who refused to slow down. Enzo Ferrari had tiptoed through a literal and figurative minefield that was World War II and survived. Now, with Italy rebuilding one block at a time, what was his next move? How did he navigate the post-war malaise to become one of the most respected car makers of the mid-century? All this and more on next week's episode, the finale of Past Gas Season 1, it's Ferrari Part 2. Wow.
Wowee, wow.
What a story. I like that, that's Past Gas Season 1, 360 episodes.
Yeah, 6 years long.
We made it to syndication.
Yeah, we did. I wish. I got to read more into this about his kind of like,
He really a fascist sympathizer?
Well, that's kind of the thing.
It's
like,
question
worst case, he is like a card-carrying fascist who supported all this stuff. Best case is like, oh, yeah, he's a guy that like just navigated all these alliances and was still working with all these guys. And I don't know. It's it's interesting because he was made very rich from working with Mussolini's government.
Making military stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
But also he was, like we were saying, is supporting socialists part, you know, like I think it's certainly in question.
It's really complicated.
He's either a moral relativist, you know, something of a sociopath who's going to do whatever he has to, or
I would say he's a sociopath.
Yeah. Or it could be that he's just trying to survive. Like he's either, you know what I mean? Like, and there is a difference there.
In part two, we learn more about his character and how he starts to be manipulative, a sociopath. So I would imagine that he's just doing everything for self-preservation and kind of just putting everything in every basket to see, you know, so he doesn't have to lose
out. We did an episode where we talked about all the drivers that died under Ferrari, right?
Yeah. And he would do this big show. He'd do this big show of like, oh, he'd go into his, you know, his apartment unit that was in his factory and you couldn't talk to him because he was so sorrowful. And he would talk to the presses and, you know, cry in front of people. But it was all kind of an act to like telegraph, you know, like, oh, I've learned my lesson. Like, I'm going to make things safer.
And you're saying actions speak louder than words.
Yeah. He understood that and he really played into that.
Complicated guy. And we're going to learn more about him, as Joe mentioned, in our next episode. Stick around for part two. We'll see you next time. I've been Nolan Sykes, Bart Bidlingmeyer across from me, Bids Bardo on Instagram. Go follow Joe at Joe G. Weber.
Yeah.
Big thank you to our crew, Mark, Edgar, and Audrey, as always. And thank you for listening. We'll see you next week.
And to our writer, Anthony, is doing our season one of JDM.
Anthony rules, dude.
Yeah.
All right. We'll see you next week. Bye.